Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't, lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing. But he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit, so I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and he said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, I wanted to be on TV. I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday. And I can hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It said, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sobel from the Comedy Caravan. This was a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there, another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This is Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was, they was interviewing Mitch Green, And he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I'd never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because the Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at the Apollo. It ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida. I make $300. Then I go to New York. I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
Okay, today, and I had something else queued up for you, but let me see if I can, well, I can get it, but man, I don't want to refresh this page. Anyway, today's podcast is titled Inflation. You can't stop it, but you sure can beat it. Oh, man. Okay, I'm trying to, all right, here we go, see if this works. Inflation is something, it's so subtle. And you really have to think into the future, particularly on your big purchases, how inflation will affect you. So you need to organize some type of plan where you can harness inflation so you can beat it, because you sure can't stop it. In any event, That's the long and short of it for today. We're going to play some other audio. We're doing a lot of planning and offline work this week. Let's see who we have. Okay. Anyway, inflation, you can't stop it, but you sure can beat it. If you got any ways that you can beat it, let us know.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build little shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out. Took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big. Because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money. And war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. they're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
There was a time when the country of Zimbabwe represented the hopes and the aspirations of the entire African continent. It was rich in natural resources, it had democratic institutions, and blacks and whites lived together in relative prosperity. The credit went to Robert Mugabe, the only president Zimbabwe has ever had. He came to power 20 years ago after waging a successful guerrilla war against what was then the white-ruled former British colony of Rhodesia. With independence, he preached conciliation and convinced many whites to stay on and participate in a new democracy. But this past year, things have gone terribly wrong in Zimbabwe. For the first time, President Mugabe is facing tough political opposition, and he has reacted by declaring war on the whites he once courted and on thousands of blacks whose only crime has been to support the political party challenging him. What was once the most promising democracy in Africa is now on the verge of economic collapse and political anarchy. This is what's going on in the countryside today. These scenes were captured by a cameraman for British television. White-owned farms and their black farm workers' houses are being seized and destroyed in a government-sanctioned campaign of racial and political violence. Seven white farmers have been killed so far, and not even their dogs are being spared. In the past year, a major slice of the white population has packed up and left the country, and thousands of well-educated, middle-class blacks are doing the same thing. In the once prosperous capital of Harare, there are shortages of food and fuel. And in Parliament, a resolution has been introduced to impeach Robert Mugabe.
When I arrived in the country this morning, the first newspaper I saw was this one.
Yes.
The latest public opinion survey says President Mugabe's popularity has declined so much that 74% of Zimbabweans want him to go. What is your reaction to this?
Nonsense, of course. Absolute nonsense.
President Mugabe calls it the politics of the moment, but the real question is whether Zimbabwe is still a democracy. At age 76, Mugabe is behaving like a man who is prepared to hold on to power at any cost. With the economy in a shambles and his political support slipping away, he is blaming the country's problems on less than 1% of the population. A few thousand white commercial farmers like Harry Milbank, who own 40% of the best land, employ 25% of the nation's workforce, and provide 40% of the nation's export earnings.
Were you told at the time of independence that you were welcome here, that you were welcome to farm?
Yeah. Mugabe started off saying, we want you farmers to stay, you're an important part of the economy, the war is behind us, let's move forward together. I was born here, brought up here, I went to school here. This is my country, I've got nowhere else to go to.
And most Zimbabweans agree he should stay. Last year, a new constitution that would have allowed the government to confiscate white farms without compensation and given Mugabe 10 more years in power was rejected by the voters. But Mugabe is carrying out the policy anyway. In the past year, more than 1,000 white farms have been illegally seized and occupied by a ragtag rural militia known as the War Veterans.
They know that the farmer is the most racist of the white citizens in the country. And the white farmer has been the crudest of the whites in this country, the most backward in terms of the enlightenment and education.
I sit here and I listen to you describe these farmers.
Yes.
If you were white and you were referring to black people that way, most people would take those to be racist comments.
Well, how do you speak about racist or racial practices without condemning them?
They're all racist, you think?
Majority of them, not all of them. There's some very good ones.
Mugabe says the war veterans are former soldiers in the war for independence who have become impatient and decided to take back the land that is theirs by birthright. But most of them are too young to have ever fought in the war, and it's widely recognized that their numbers are made up largely of jobless youths, officers from Central Intelligence, and paid volunteers for Mugabe's political party. They are led by Chenjerai Hunzi, a messianic physician who likes to be called by his nom de guerre, which is Hitler. He says anyone who resists the farm takeovers will end up 6 feet under. President Mugabe is his organization's official patron.
He has your support.
Yes, of course.
Even though he likes to refer to himself as Hitler.
Of course. But what is in a name?
It isn't just the name. Martin Olds was one of the first white farmers to be murdered before the June election. His wife, Kathy, a polio victim, says war veterans backed up by Mugabe's North Korean-trained special forces surrounded the farm and ambushed her husband. He managed to hold them off for several hours with a hunting rifle and a shotgun, all the while calling for assistance on his radio.
They got into the yard and the petrol from the vehicles in the workshop they used to make Molotov cocktails, which they then threw into the house. Martin's last stand was from our bath, where he'd filled it with water to get away from the heat. And obviously when things got too hot for him, he tried to make a run for it and they shot him, mutilated his body, and then started pillaging the property.
The same week, another white farmer, David Stevens, who had risked his life by openly campaigning for Mugabe's opposition, was kidnapped by a gang of war veterans who seized his farm and hauled him off to the nearest town.
The mob brought David Stevens here to the police station in Marewa. But instead of protecting him, the police stood around doing nothing, allowing his kidnappers to drag him off to a nearby cave where he was tied up, beaten, forced to drink diesel fuel, and shot twice in the face.
David stood up for what he thought was right. And that's what killed him.
Maria Stevens is his widow.
Was your husband armed that day?
No. David was never armed. We did not have weapons to have as for security.
And you think the police were part of this?
I don't think. I know.
Who do you hold responsible for this?
I am holding our president responsible for this.
Maria Stevens, wife of David Stevens, who was a farmer that was killed,
mm-hmm.
reportedly forced to drink diesel fuel, shot twice in the face by war veterans. His wife says that you should be held personally accountable for his death.
Why? I wasn't there. I didn't give instructions to anyone.
What do you say to Mrs. Stevens? Are you sorry that her husband was killed?
We're sorry for any death that occurs. But they provoked the war veterans. They shouldn't have done it. They should have been more careful. And they can't lay the blame on us then.
President Mugabe told us that your husband provoked this violence, that he was responsible for his own death.
That is what Mugabe would like to believe, because it's his only way to get out of this.
The story will continue after this. Amnesty International has called the violence state-sponsored terrorism, and it's not just white farmers who are being killed in Zimbabwe. Most of the victims of political violence have been black. In the past year, more than 30 members of the opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, have been murdered, and thousands more have reported incidents of assault and intimidation. Adela Chiminya's husband was out campaigning when he was attacked by a crowd of Mugabe supporters near a service station.
He started beating him with the iron bars and some stones. then they poured some petrol and burnt him.
They set fire to him after he became unconscious?
Yes.
Where were the police when this happened?
They were at a distance watching.
They could see it going on?
Yes.
These acts are being orchestrated from the top.
Paul Nyathi is a member of parliament and a party spokesman for the MDC, which won nearly half of the seats contested in the past election. He's also a distinguished veteran from the War of Independence.
President Mugabe himself is on record as telling the nation of Zimbabwe that those that are opposed to his rule will be killed.
What do you think about what President Mugabe is doing with the white farmers?
It's absolutely horrendous. It's disgusting. If land is required, let that land be acquired legally. Unleashing unlawful war veterans to go and intimidate white farmers, beat them up, it's not what a president of a country does.
Nyathi says most previous attempts to resettle war veterans on good farmland have failed miserably, and that's according to the government's own studies. Most have neither the skills nor the resources to make a go of it. And 2 years ago, the government had to repossess 250 farms that had been given to war veterans. But the policy may be the only way Mugabe can hold on to the support he has left in the rural countryside, and he's not backing down. When we were talking in the fields with farmer Harry Milbank, a group of war veterans appeared on the horizon.
Can you just get hold of the police there that they've come on? They're approaching us at the moment, and we'll see what they do.
Okay, so they've undone the gate?
Yeah, confirmed.
One of the farm workers told us that the war veterans were coming to break our cameras, and concerned that our presence was inflaming the situation, we retreated, at Milbank's urging, to a nearby ridge where we could record what was happening. After haranguing and trying to intimidate Milbank, the war veterans, aware of our presence, decided they would be better off talking to the cameras instead of breaking them. Their leader, Fanuel Chigwederi, told us he was just following orders.
We are not doing this on our own, but we are following the orders from the superior, that is from the government.
Mr. Milbank says that the legal process has not taken its course, that he has not been told to give up his land by the courts, and that he has a legal right to stay on it.
If he is going to argue with us, he is committing suicide.
What do you mean he's committing suicide?
Ms. Milbank is very stubborn, and we are going to take this farm whether he likes it or not. Don't put yourself into danger. If he misquote us, then I know we've got your names and we'll get you. This will be the last time to come here for you.
The threats are not to be taken lightly. An average of two farmers a week are attacked with pickaxes, machetes, and whips. Ian Hardy was beaten and tortured within an inch of his life when he went to the Marewa police station to try and rescue David Stevens. He doesn't expect anyone to be punished for it, in part because President Mugabe has granted a blanket pardon to anyone liable to criminal prosecution for politically motivated crimes, with the exception of murder. Just one more reason why Hardy and his wife Marjo want to leave.
You don't think it's safe here anymore?
No, definitely not.
Are you looking forward to getting out of the country?
I'm nervous, but I'm not prepared to take another chance of losing my husband. Because it could happen again, and the chances of it happening again is very high.
There are plenty of other reasons to leave. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have suspended all financial assistance, and the currency reserves are exhausted. Money from the current tobacco crop is already running low. There may not be a next one. The fuel crisis has brought hard times to the townships. These women told us bus fare is often more than their family salary. And Zimbabwe's game parks, the centerpiece of a once strong tourist industry, are empty. Some, like this one at Amiri, are occupied by war veterans.
What happens to the animals?
I'll try and look after them through thick and thin.
86-year-old Norman Travers worries that the rare black rhinos they breed here and the elephants they train will be poached and eaten.
Will you stay here?
Of course. This is my country. I love it.
Would you be happy to see all the white people leave Zimbabwe?
No. I've stayed so out of anger.
Would you be happy if they left?
If they left on their own accord, good. They would make land more available. Why not?
My home is not for sale. And if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe.
What Jim Salit is talking about is the city of Lakewood, Ohio, taking his house, his home, through eminent domain to make way for a high-priced condo that will pay the city more in taxes than he and his wife Joanne do. And he says he's not going to take it lying down.
It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Ed Bradley.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Those stories and Andy Rooney tonight on 60 Minutes.
Just about everyone knows that under a process called eminent domain, the government can and does seize private property for public use to build a road or a courthouse. But did you know the government can also seize your land for private use if they can prove that doing it will serve what is called the public good? Cities across the country have been using eminent domain to force people off their land so that private developers can build more expensive homes and offices, which will pay more in property taxes than the buildings they are replacing. Under eminent domain, the government buys your property, paying you what is determined to be fair market value. But now, people who don't want to sell their homes at any price just to see their land go to another private owner are fighting back.
The bottom line is, this is morally wrong, what they're doing here. This is our home, and we're going to stay here, and I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
Jim and Joanne Salit are refusing to sell the home they've lived in for 38 years in a quiet neighborhood of single-family houses in Lakewood, Ohio, just outside Cleveland. The city of Lakewood is trying to use eminent domain to force the Salits out to make way for more expensive condominiums. But the Salits are in effect telling the town, hell no, they won't go.
We talked about this when we were dating. I used to point to the houses and say, Joanne, one of these days we're going to have one of these houses. And I meant it. And I worked hard.
What'd you do?
I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And we worked very hard for this and paid it off. And we said, oh, we've got it. We paid off our home. I retired. And now we're going to spend the rest of our days here and pass this on to our children.
But Lakewood's mayor, Madeline Kane, has other plans. She wants to tear down the Salits' home, plus 55 homes around it, along with four apartment buildings and more than a dozen businesses, so that private developers can build high-priced condominiums and a high-end shopping mall, and thus raise Lakewood's property tax base.
This is a project.
The mayor told us she sought out a developer for the project because Lakewood's aging tax base has been shrinking and the city simply needs more money.
This is about Lakewood's future. Lakewood cannot survive without a strengthened tax base. Is it right to consider this a public good? Absolutely.
What you're saying effectively is that the Salits neighborhood has to be sacrificed for the greater good of the city of Lakewood.
I guess I'm saying that that neighborhood is being asked to, and it's difficult and it's unfortunate that they are being asked to give up their home.
They want this whole area because of the view of the park.
Well, it's a beautiful view.
It is an awesome view. They know it's gorgeous and they want it. It's that simple.
This whole area is called Scenic Park, but that's the problem. Because it is so scenic, it's a prime place to build upscale condominiums with great views over the Rocky River. Those condos will be a cinch to sell.
But the condos can't go up unless the city can remove the Salits and their neighbors through eminent domain. And to legally invoke eminent domain, the city had to certify that this scenic park area is really, quote, blighted.
We're not blighted. This is an area that we absolutely love. It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And, Mike, you don't know how humiliating this is to have people tell you you live in a blighted area and how degrading this is.
You're the mayor. You know the place. Tell me what is blighted about that area.
The term blighted is a statutory word. It is. It really doesn't have a lot to do with whether or not your home is painted.
It is a legal
statutory
term.
Meaning?
That is used to describe an area. And the question is whether or not that area can be used for a higher and better use. Whether
What does that mean, a higher and better use? What's higher and better than a home?
The term blight is used to describe whether or not the structures generally in an area meet today's standards.
And it's the city that sets those standards. So Lakewood set a standard for blight that would include most of the homes in the neighborhood. A home could be considered blighted if it doesn't have the following.
3 bedrooms, 2 baths, an attached 2-car garage, and central air. Now, this community is over 100 years old. Who has all those things?
You mean it's blighted if it doesn't have 3 bedrooms?
Those things I just told you. That's the criteria. And it's ridiculous.
You don't have central air?
No, and we don't need it because of the air. We always have a breeze.
Sure.
Right off Lake Erie,
beautiful.
The breeze comes right through here all the time. We counted all the attached garages in Lakewood. There's 20 in the whole city.
We counted 20.
And by the way, we got up at a meeting and told the mayor and all 7 council members their houses are blighted according to this criteria.
My understanding is that using the criteria that are in place, more than 90% of the houses in Lakewood could be deemed blighted, including the houses of the mayor and of every one of the city council members. True? Do you have 2 bathrooms?
No.
Blight. 2-car garage?
No.
Blight. Is the garage attached?
No.
Blight. And your lot size is under 5,000 square feet?
Oh, well under.
You've called that area a cute little neighborhood. You didn't call it a cute little blighted neighborhood. I mean, you and I know that it's not a blighted neighborhood.
I would never personally walk that neighborhood and indicate that that neighborhood is not attractive or, I mean, I would never say that.
It's a cute little neighborhood.
It is a cute little neighborhood. You'll get me to say it on the record. It is a cute little neighborhood.
Cute? Maybe. But without those new condos, it won't produce enough property taxes to satisfy the mayor and the city council.
That's no excuse for taking my home. My home is not for sale. And if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe in the whole country, not only Ohio, but this is rampant all over the country. It's like a plague.
This is a nationwide epidemic. We have documented more than 10,000 instances of government taking property from one person to give it to another in just the last 5 years.
Dana Berliner and Scott Bullock are attorneys at a libertarian nonprofit group called the Institute for Justice, which has filed suit on behalf of the Salites against the city of Lakewood. They claim that taking private property this way is unconstitutional.
It is fundamentally wrong and contrary to the Constitution for the government to take property from one private owner and hand it over to another private owner just because the government thinks that person is going to make more productive use of the land.
Everyone knows that property can be taken for a road, but nobody thinks that property can be taken to give it to their neighbor or the large business down the street for their economic benefit. People are shocked when they hear that this is going on around the country.
And it's not just people's homes that are the targets in these eminent domain cases. The Institute for Justice has also filed suit against the city of Mesa, Arizona, to save Randy Bailey's brake repair shop, the shop he got from his father and hopes someday to pass on to his son. The city of Mesa is citing the need for redevelopment. He's trying to force Bailey to relocate to make way for an Ace Hardware store that would look better and pay more taxes.
Redevelopment to me is, work with the existing people there and redevelop.
Right.
Not, you get out, we're bringing this guy in.
Bailey's Brake Service has been on this corner for more than 30 years.
In Mesa, this is the corner, Main Street and Country Club. There's not a better corner in this city.
And business has been pretty good down the years?
Business has been awesome.
Now, what used to be in all of this property? I mean, everything else has disappeared.
The city come in and got immediate possession and started demolishing it, making it dirt.
The city has made dirt out of 3 restaurants and 4 businesses that once stood on this 5-acre lot.
And it's not just business properties that they're doing this on. You know, they wiped out 8 people's homes over here. You know, your home ain't even safe.
Bailey told us his neighbors let the city buy them out, but he's refusing to sell.
I'm standing in their way. I'm their thorn in their side.
The thorn in the side of Ken Linhart, who owns the Ace Hardware store a few blocks away. Linhart wants a much bigger store. He could have negotiated with Bailey, but instead, he convinced the city of Mesa to try to buy Bailey's land through eminent domain and then sell it to him.
The city of Mesa wants to move Mr. Bailey about a block away. And from what I understand, it's going to be a new building, new equipment, moving expenses, and everything set up for him. I don't see how Mr. Bailey's going to get hurt.
You can't replace a business in the same location. This place was built in 1952 as a break-in front-end shop. I don't care where you move into City Mesa, it would never be the same.
So Bailey went to Linhart looking for a way to stay on his corner.
I tried to go to him and see if we couldn't work something out on this. And he told me, no, there ain't room for you there. We're going to let the city just take care of you.
Did you ever sit down and try to negotiate with him?
No, I never did.
Redevelopment seems to me to make obvious good sense. But the right of eminent domain to take one man's private property, Randy Bailey, to give it, in effect, to Ken Linhart for his private property.
It happens all over the country. Practically any town you want to go to, they're redeveloping their town centers.
Right.
Now, are we going to sit in Mesa, Arizona, and have our town center decay? As a citizen of Mesa, I don't want that to happen.
If I'd had a for sale sign out there, it'd been a whole different deal. And for them to come in and tell me how much my property is worth, and for me to get out because they're bringing in somebody else, when I own the land, is unfounded to me. It don't even sound like the United States.
And this isn't happening just in small towns. Right here in New York City, a few blocks away from Times Square, New York State has forced a man to sell land on that corner over there that his family had owned for more than 100 years. And what's going up instead? A courthouse? A school? Nope. The new headquarters of the New York Times. It seems the world's most prestigious newspaper wants to build a new home on this block. But Stratford Wallace and the block's other property owners did not want to sell. Wallace told us the newspaper never tried to negotiate with him. Instead, the Times teamed up with a major real estate developer, and together they convinced the state to use eminent domain to force Wallace out by declaring the block blighted.
I challenge them. This is not blighted property, nor is this property over here blighted.
But New York State Supreme Court disagreed. The court ruled that the newspaper's new headquarters would eliminate blight, and that even though a private entity, the New York Times, is the main beneficiary, improving the block would benefit the public. New York Times executives would not talk to us about it on camera. Back in Lakewood, Ohio, Jim and Joanne Salid are still waiting for their court decision. Most of their neighbors have agreed to sell if the project goes ahead, but the Salids plus a dozen others are hanging tough.
I thought I bought this place, but I guess I just leased it until the city wants it. That's what makes me very angry. This is my dream home, and I'm going to fight for it.
Now the fight is moving to the ballot box. Lakewood residents opposed to the development have gathered enough signatures to force a citywide referendum on it come November.
What's up, guys? This is Alex Martin, and this is the Content Creator Podcast, where I stimulate your mind and show you how to market your grind. And today, we're going to stimulate your mind. I got the legend, the icon, Freeway Rick Ross. How you doing today, bro?
I'm good. How you?
I'm good, bro. Can't complain.
No doubt.
I can't lie, man. Right now, I'm like, I got the jitters, you know.
I see you geeked.
Yeah, I'm excited. And first, I want to say thank you. Like, you didn't have to come here. And yeah, you did it, man, so I appreciate it.
Oh, come on, man, this is how I do. You know, everybody's important.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's movement is important. Even if it's not important to me, it's important to them. And if I don't respect your movement, you shouldn't respect mine. So
you're big on respect.
Absolutely.
Like, that's one of the things, like, when I did my research, you know, one of the things that you said was, You just like want to respect everybody. You don't want no enemies.
No, I don't.
Where did that start?
I don't know. You know, my mom was always kind of like open. You know, like my house was the place everybody played basketball in my backyard, and we played football on the side of the street, and you know, we had food everybody could eat. You know, at our house, so it was kind of like an open society. You know what I'm saying? In a loving environment. Even though, you know, sometimes it was chaotic as well, but I guess I got it, you know, from being around my mom with that kind of open openness, you know, the willing to accept other people, and sometimes even if you don't agree with, you know, their philosophies, you know, it was still okay to be friends.
Yeah, nah, that's real. That's one of the things I felt like the older generation, like y'all, are better at. Because y'all can disagree to agree on certain issues.
Yeah, yeah.
Our generation, man, they be on some bullshit. You know, everybody.
Well, now they want to kill you if they don't like what you say. You know, I don't like what you say. I don't like what you wear. You know, I'm gonna kill you.
Yeah.
So definitely a different time.
Speaking of which, I saw you take a picture with Mike Bloomberg. Politics is mainly where that happens. So. What's up with that?
Well, you know, it was interesting, and I caught a lot of slack behind it off my social media, and you know, I tell my people that you know, I don't work for nobody.
Yeah.
You know, I never had a job, so I don't really know what it's like to have to take orders from anybody.
Definitely.
And I kind of make my own mind up. You know, I do my own study, my own analyzation. And I'll take other people's opinion, and I'll even chop it up with you about the situation, you know. But at the end of the day, I'm going to go with what I believe, even if I have to take the lick, you know. Okay, I was wrong.
Yeah.
Spank my ass, you know.
Accountability.
Accountability, you know. So I got a call, you know, from the mayor of Compton, and she was like, Bloomberg is going to be in town. Would you like to meet him? And... you know, all I do is listen to the news. You know, I don't really listen to hip hop or the radio. You know, my station is always tuned to the news because every now and then they'll drop a jewel that'll throw you out front.
That's what I'm getting right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I like to hear the people come on, the experts, and talk about, you know, just like the coronavirus. I've been really keeping up with that.
I'm going to go into that afterwards.
Okay.
They got something against us.
And she called me and she was like, Mike Bloomberg is going to be in Compton. I was like, Compton? This dude is worth $58 billion and he's going to be in Compton?
Yeah.
You know, some of our stars never come to Compton.
Yeah.
You know, I think the last time Dr. Dre was in Compton is when they were shooting straight out of Compton when the incident happened with Suge.
Yeah.
You know, that's how often they come to Compton.
And that's 2020, and that's probably 2013. No, 2014, maybe.
That was
a long time ago, though.
It was a while.
Yeah. So you got a billionaire coming.
So what I'm saying is that people don't come to Compton.
Yeah.
They don't come to L.A., South Central. We just don't see those guys. Here, Mike Bloomberg, he's in Compton. You know, he's walking the streets. You know, like the same guy that I listened to on the radio was talking about, oh, I'm finna put money into the black community.
Yeah,
I want to know, are you telling the truth?
Yeah.
Are you really gonna put money in South Central? And if you are, I'm the one that you should be going through.
Yeah.
You know, you should be talking to me about putting money into my community, because a lot of times they put money in, but they give it to the wrong people.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny you say that. I've worked with people with the same mindset as you. Independent, be your own boss. We don't allow no Red Cross, no nothing in between.
Why should we?
Yeah.
When the people are saying that they want to do it, why shouldn't we go out and let them do it with us?
Yeah.
Somebody that the community trusts.
Right.
Somebody who loves the community. I really love South Central.
Yeah.
You know, I love my people.
Yeah.
You know, I love all my followers on social media. You know, I guarantee you, you know, not one of them will ever tell you that they came up to me and told me that they follow me and I didn't, you know, give them a brother hug and, you know, we go eat dinner together.
Yeah.
You know, they go to the arenas with me.
Yeah.
because I don't feel that it's big me, little you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's humble, man.
I feel that we all equal and we all deserve the same amount of respect. You know, and you know, and I understood the Friskin search. You know, can't nobody can really talk about it more than I can.
Yeah.
I got the scars in my face that prove police brutality. All of this is from police brutality.
Yeah.
All these scars. You know, nobody on the street do that.
Yeah.
Police did that while I was handcuffed. So when you're talking about police brutality, I know police brutality too well. Matter of fact, I'm going to court right now. I was sitting in my car about 4 months ago. Me and my son were sitting in the car. One of my friends that came in, and he got one of those tickets where they give you the hotel and the car. You know how you buy those tickets online, and you don't know where your hotel is.
Yeah. It's like the app, too, nowadays. You got
so, man, he got this hotel,
yeah.
And when we pulled up, I was like, wow. You know, this looked like one of them spots.
No, really?
Yeah, but it was, you know, I mean, it was. But anyway, he goes to check in. I'm parked in the loading zone, and the cop pulls in with his lights out. And I swear, it was people all over the place.
Yeah.
And this cop pulled right up to my car.
Out of all the cars.
Out of all the cars, all the people walking.
Yeah.
He pulled right up to us. And he walked up to my window. And he asked me for my ID. I gave him my ID. And my registration, insurance, everything, you know, because I'm straight. You know, I'm an auto dealer. And he was complaining about the car didn't have a plate on the front. So I said, oh, well, I'm a dealer, and I got a dealer plate on the back.
Yeah.
So my car don't have to have a plate on it, don't have to be registered or nothing.
Yeah.
Here's my WIC card for the auction. And he takes it and he runs it. And then his partner comes over to my son, and he's like, you on probation or parole? And my son was like, yeah. And instantly, everything changed. It was like, get out of the car. And I'm like, hold up.
Yeah.
Y'all got the right to demand him out, but you can't demand me out because I'm not on parole.
Yeah.
No, you get out of the car too, put his hand on his pistol. So I got out of the car, you know, because I know they will shoot us.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
We know incidents that people have done nothing but wearing a hoodie, and I did have on a hoodie.
Yeah.
You know, I keep my hoodie on.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I got out the car, and after I got out the car, he asked me to sit on the ground. I'm like, I don't sit on the ground, unless I want to sit on the ground. I don't want to sit on the ground tonight,
yeah.
You know? He said, if you don't sit on the ground, I'm going to take you to jail. And I said, well, you're going to have to take me to jail. Because you might take me down, but I ain't sitting down.
Yeah.
And when I said that, that's exactly what he did. He took me down.
So he hit you with like evading arrest? Or?
He charged me with obstruction. I'm charged right now. I'm going to court right now.
Yeah.
With obstructing an investigation and resisting arrest. So when you're talking about police brutality, I know it firsthand. I have my own task force. And these guys, 35 got suspended. I think 6 or 7 went to prison,
yeah.
You know, for civil rights violations, stealing money, planting drugs, lying on the witness stand, fabricating search warrants. So when you talk about corruption with police, I know it firsthand. I testified against those cops, you know, that one night they planted drugs on me, you know, they planted drugs on my girlfriend, my mom, they planted a gun at my mom's daycare center. Just to take her license, just taxes to cause you financial heartache is what they were doing. So when you talk about police brutality, I know it firsthand. But I also understand that everybody deserves a second chance. You know, we've all made mistakes. You know, I'm no longer a crack dealer, and I know that selling crack was probably one of the worst things I ever did before in my life. And I've done quite a few things. You know, I'm not a saint. But selling crack may have been the worst thing that I ever did and the least thing that I'm fond that I've done in my life, even though that gave me my notoriety, my fame, and all that. I know that so many other people suffered from me being able to drive a car with a nice paint job or have wheels on it or have some nice clothes or have a house. Somebody else, kid, probably went hungry. Because the mom has been to food stamps or whatever in order to facilitate this high. And I'm asking people to give me a second chance, you know. So if I want a second chance, shouldn't I allow other people to have a second chance?
For sure. And like that's in a way, like that's avoiding, because we all hypocrites in our own right. But it's like when you're mindful of it, I feel like self-awareness, I feel like that helps out a lot to where you just like, you know, where you just a second chance. For me, it's like being open to other people's opinions. It's like, you know, if I disagree with you, I don't have to, you know, you're like, I don't have to damn my feelings about that shit.
Yeah, you don't have to crucify them.
Yeah,
you know.
From it, like, oh, you got their point of view. That's that. Let it, you know, let it live.
Right.
So how did the meeting go with Mike Bloomberg?
Well, we just met briefly that day. I'm hoping that that the dialogue will continue.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know where it's gonna go, but at the end of the day, I think that we all should hold him accountable for his words, and we shouldn't just, you know, throw up our hands and say, oh no, I don't want no parts of that. Because one of the things that I like about what he said is that at least he's saying he's gonna do something for the black community.
Yeah, for sure.
No other president has ever said, I'm going to do this specifically for the black community.
Yeah.
Hasn't been done. Obama didn't do it.
Yeah.
Obama never said that he was going to do anything for the black community.
Yeah.
And we love Obama.
Yeah.
You know, we put him in presidency. But he never once committed a certain thing to the black community.
Yeah.
And for Bloomberg to at least say it, maybe he won't do it. I'm not saying that he's gonna do it.
Yeah.
You know, I never said that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying at least he said that he wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And that he's going to do it. So with that, to me, is a step ahead of everybody else.
Okay. Nah, I feel that then. So if people on social media, y'all need to chill in the comment section. I've seen the comments. Y'all need to chill. Take a break.
Well, you know what? And they have the right to voice their opinion.
Sure.
But what I would like for them to do is not only make an opinion, but also do the research to go with your opinion. Because now if you're basing your opinion on non-facts, then it's just an opinion.
Yeah.
And opinions don't really mean much without the research and the facts to go behind it. So I would prefer for my people to do the research. And then on top of that, let's hold him accountable, because he may win. He may win the presidency. You know, I think they say he spent already $170 million, more than everybody. And Trump can't keep up with him, because you know he said Trump ain't a real billionaire.
Yeah, he's what was it? They talking to him about the Twitter deal.
Yeah,
Twitter exchange that they had, and you know they asked him, and he said, you know, do you think it's fair? I'm paraphrasing. You know, do you think it's right to argue in public with, you know, for kids to see two billionaires arguing in public? And he went, who's the other billionaire?
Well, you know, he's not the only one that said Trump is not a billionaire.
Yeah,
you know, my guy that owns Virgin Records, I can't think of his name right now,
Richard Branson.
Richard Branson also said that he's not a billionaire, and he makes billionaires look bad.
Yeah, speaking of billionaire status, as you move, you know, and I'm structuring it the right way, you were considered a billionaire at one point in time.
Yeah, some people say that.
Yeah. How was that, like, when you were, like, in that time period?
Well, you know what, when I was selling cocaine, I loved it. You know, I was willing to die for it, kill for it, but I was lost. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't in my right mind, because had I been in my right mind, I could have taken what I had and not only set myself up, but so many other people.
Were you like ever like counting like how much money was coming in? Because I know for me personally, like I set a number for me. At one point in my life, I want to make $50 million. I don't know how it's going to happen. I hope that it's tech. So, like, was there ever a number, like, growing up?
My number will change. You know, when I first started selling drugs, I wanted to make $5,000.
Really?
That was my goal. I just wanted to put some wheels on my car, get my car painted, and I was going to be good with that.
So did you always have the entrepreneurial mindset?
I guess I always did, but I didn't really know what an entrepreneur was.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in a poor house, you know, single family, you know, only the moms. And my mom knew nothing about business, you know. She didn't know about structuring a business, how to start a business. But, you know, even when I was a kid, I used to organize car washes with all my friends. I would cut the grass. I used to hustle bottles, cans. So I guess I've always had the entrepreneur skill.
Yeah.
But I never knew how to channel those energies into what I eventually learned how to channel it into.
Yeah. So now you're doing the in the marijuana industry?
Yes, I'm going to be the king of marijuana. I plan on being the biggest marijuana dealer in the whole country.
Yeah.
That's my goal. I don't have a number of how much money I want to make. I don't even care about the money.
Yeah.
I just want to be the biggest. I just want to dominate the industry.
Yeah.
I want my brand to be the biggest brand in the industry.
Yeah. And it's LA Kingpins, right?
Yeah, LA Kingpin.
Yeah. How long you had this going, you know? And what made you even jump into the industry?
It was a long story, man. I just got off parole, and I wasn't doing well financially. I was getting eviction notices on my door because I was paying half my rent and couldn't pay the other half. And sometimes I'd be $200 short, and sometimes I'd be $700 short. And I just wasn't in a space that I wanted to be in, you know, financially. And one of my guys came by, you know, to celebrate with me the day I got off parole. And a white guy out of Ohio named Matt. He's a stoner. He's a real stoner.
Okay.
I'm talking about a real stoner. When you see stoner, he's a real stoner. So he came by and he was like, man, I'm going to San Bernardino to the High Times event. You ought to ride with me. You off parole, come and celebrate, smoke a joint. And I was like, man, I ain't smoking no weed. And, because I hadn't smoked weed since the early 80s, you know.
And so, hold on, what year is this that you get off parole?
I got off I don't even remember what year it was. Probably like, let me see, I did 6 years on paper, so it would have been 09, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15.
Okay.
So he talks me into going to the event with him. He's like, man, I bet you'll sell a lot of books out there.
Yeah.
And so I went and grabbed 6 boxes of books, like 200 books, and we headed out, man.
Yeah.
And just like he said, I didn't even get in the gate, and they started buying them books. Man, Rick Ross, man, we love you.
Yeah.
Thank you for all you did for us, for your sacrifice. And basically they were saying that with me exposing the CIA's actions in the cocaine also helped make marijuana legal in California. So they just showed me so much love, man. It was like this new environment that I never saw before.
Yeah.
I never saw people with like trash bags of marijuana, big jars of marijuana like this big, just sitting on the table in the open, and then the cops are walking by protecting it, and people are smoking weed, and man, they was giving me like, I was tripping, right, because I don't even know that I'm going, but then there's people here like, man, I made this popsicle for you, it's vegan.
Yeah.
I made this sucker for you, it's vegan. I made this candy bar for you, it's vegan.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is the kind of love I'm going to get?
Yeah.
So they bought all the books, so I didn't have to carry no boxes outside. I had a big wad of money.
Yeah.
And man, dudes was coming up with money, wads of money like this, like we used to have when we sold cocaine.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I want some of this.
Yeah. I can feel that.
So when I went home that night, I called my brothers and I was like, man, y'all didn't tell me about this, man. Because at that time, what I noticed, I had never even noticed that it was a marijuana industry.
Yeah.
You know, because I was kind of like, you know, it's kind of like when you your tunnel vision, and my vision was to get off parole because I had to appeal from hell. This guy was trying to send me back for everything. So I know what I had done is I had done just what I was supposed to do to get off parole. And I also kind of felt like, you know, getting into marijuana would be a stepping stone of me going back to selling cocaine. But then what I realized is that I had already committed to myself that I was never going to sell cocaine again, so I didn't have to worry about that. You know, that was already established. Yeah, that's over with. Right. So no matter what happens, you're not going back.
Yeah.
But then I was like, it's legal.
Yeah.
Rick, it's legal, Rick. You can get a license. You're going to have a permit. You know, you get to ride around with the paperwork. So I jumped in, man. I started with $500. And I did pretty good. I got up to they stopped me on the highway one day. I was going up to the mountains to buy marijuana, and they stopped me. I had $105,000 in the car. The police took my money. But I started to do really, really well in the industry. I saw the similarities between the marijuana and my skills that I use in the cocaine business.
Yeah. So if you had to give advice to people right now, like monetary wise, what would it be as far as like applying it to the industry?
Well, with any business that you go into, you want to be focused. You want to have tunnel vision. At least during the time that you're doing whatever it is that you're trying to do. You know, you want to be focused right into that. You don't want to, I mean, let's use boxing, for instance, because, you know, I'm working with, as a matter of fact, we got a fighter fighting tonight. Saul Rodriguez is one of my guys. I've been working with Saul since he was 16. I went to a fight, and he was 16 years old. He came up to me, and he was like, man, you should be managing me. I'm going to be the champ. And I was like, this little boy, get out of here. And here I am now in Dallas. He's the main event tonight. But you have to really be focused on whatever it is you're going to do, because if you don't want to be the best, then you just want to be mediocre.
Right.
And if you're mediocre, you're going to get mediocre pay.
Facts.
But if you're great, you know, why? I just do so much studying. You know, I study like Michael Jordan. Why was Michael Jordan getting $45 million a year? And then they got another guy who's only getting $500,000.
Right.
Was this guy... was Michael that much better than this guy that he should get what?
45.
That's what, 100 times more
more money
than this other guy. So what was the difference? Well, skill set, but Michael focused on what he was doing. This other guy probably was playing around, you know, last one to practice, first one to leave, you know, slacking on all of his workouts, you know, wouldn't do his shoot-arounds like he's supposed to. And that's usually, you know, people say, oh, well, they get talent. Well, my teacher says that the talented guys are always first to practice and the last to leave. So maybe work ethic and talent goes together. You know what I'm saying? Maybe there's something that can't be separated. You know, because I hear people all the time arguing, you know, oh, well, he's just a natural. Well, somebody what I would call a natural is a guy who never picked up a ball before and comes on the court and totally dominates. I never saw that before.
Nah, this is fact. He's talking about LeBron and how much he invests in his body. And, you know, at least they say like millions he spends on his body. But, you know, the guys like that, they put that time in. You know, even like listening to you talk earlier, you do your research.
You have to do your research.
Yeah.
I mean, without research and without knowledge,
and applying it,
you're going to suffer.
Yeah.
You know?
And I had struggled with that for so long, man. It like literally, I would, I'll be a big reader, but I wouldn't apply it.
Yeah, you gotta apply it. You know, in one of my most favorite articles, LA Magazine, they did an article on me, and it's called Rick Ross is Dreaming.
Yeah.
You gotta read that article one day. I was in prison with a life sentence, and a guy comes up and visits me, and he's talking about me reading these books, this Get Rich. I mean, I really didn't have no option. I had a life sentence without the possibility of parole. They tell me I'm never going home again.
Yeah.
And I start reading these books. and he calls them the get-rich-quick genre. You know, what the mind of a man can believe, the body can achieve.
Yeah.
And he said that I was testing out their plausibility. And you know, I didn't know what plausibility meant.
Yeah.
So I went and looked it up in the dictionary. And plausibility means that I was checking to see if they really worked. And that's what happens with us. We don't check the plausibility. We just take our opinion and run with it. I believe that everything that we do, everything that we hear, should be tested. One of my favorite books, Think and Grow Rich, he talks about having an open mind.
Yeah.
You know, can you open your mind up to accept new things? He asked me a question one day. I read the book like 25 times,
yeah,
too.
That, and then I know The Richest Man in Babylon.
It's another one of my favorites,
yeah,
too. Yes.
So you're big into the Get Rich Quick book.
I don't really figure, I don't even think they're Get Rich Quick books,
because
they don't talk about that you're going to get rich quick overnight. You know,
it's really about the mindset.
The mindset.
Yeah.
The dedication, the sacrifice, the burning desire, all those things play a big part in becoming successful. And so often people think that when they see somebody like a Michael Bloomberg that he was lucky.
Yeah.
You know, now a Donald Trump whose daddy and granddaddy was rich is a different story. But that's why he's been jacking off all their money.
Yeah.
You know, they say he lost more money than anybody in the bankrupt twice. I think last year they say he lost $800 million or something of other people's money.
Yeah. That's crazy. And, you know, that's another thing, too, man. I hear a lot of guys preaching, and, like, I can't really speak on it because I haven't applied it yet. But, like, the whole use other people's money.
Oh, I love
it.
Yeah, I love that.
Okay.
But I took it a step further.
Okay. Talk about it.
See, when I was in prison, that's what they talked about, using other people's money.
Okay.
So I was like, wow, what's more valuable than money? No.
What is it?
Their brain.
Go ahead.
Huh?
That's
an
OG.
Listen to me. What's more valuable than their money? Their brain.
Yeah.
Why? Because their mind generated the money.
That's game.
So if you know what they know, you can generate what they generate. It's just like baking a cake. If I show you the recipe to bake a cake, all you got to do is follow that same recipe. You're going to get the exact same cake.
Yeah.
As long as you keep it in the oven just the same amount of time. Now don't keep it in there 10 minutes longer because you might burn that thing.
Yeah.
Don't take it out early. Don't put extra milk or eggs or whatever the ingredients, the flour, put just like the ingredients, say you can get the exact same cake.
Yeah.
So what I said is, why not use their brain?
Yeah.
No, let them keep their money.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that you're good with networking then.
Oh, I love networking.
Yeah.
I'm a networking fool.
Which is why you're big on respect. So, hold on, yeah, come on, man. It's like, come on, drop that game. So, all right, when you're networking, what's like the first thing, like, let's just say people skills.
Listen more than you speak.
Okay.
Because if you talking and they can't talk,
mm-hmm.
and if they talking and you talking, you can't hear what they said.
Right. They say you can't transmit and receive.
So I'm big on listening.
Yeah.
You know, I like to do my talking too.
Yeah.
You know, but when I'm around people who are spitting game, I listen.
Gotcha.
You know.
Yeah.
I'm good at copying people. You know, somebody say, don't be no copycat. Well, my man say, make sure you copying the right cat.
Yeah. I once heard Shaq say, like, this is at the time when I was doing music. He was like, whatever you do, do a remix. Like, what you saw, throw your spin on there, but make it better.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Same scenario.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we copy somebody, copy the right cat. Because you're going to be copying somebody. Everything that we know, we learned from somebody.
Speaking of learning, you're an author. First off, let me tell you, I know that you couldn't read as a kid?
Yes. I didn't know how to read until I was 28.
Wow. So how did you, what made you get into, reading?
Well, I was in prison, and they told me that I was never going home again. And there was some old cats, you know what I'm saying, that was jailhouse lawyers, and they was like, man, you count on your lawyer to get you out?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I got a good lawyer, man. He went to Harvard University, top of his class, and I'm paying him well. He's like, man, that dude got kids. I was like, yeah. You think he care more about you than his kids? I was like, nah, I know better than that. He got a wife. Yeah, he got a wife, man. You think he cared more about you than his wife? I was like, nah. He got a practice? I said, yeah, he got his own law firm. You think he cared more about you than his law firm? I was like, nah, he ain't gonna risk his law firm for me. He got other clients too, don't he? Now, he might care more about you than his other clients, but he don't care more about you than all his other clients put together.
Yeah.
I was like, are you right? They was like, so you think he wants you out of jail better than you should want yourself out of jail? And I was like, no, you right.
Yeah.
I better get on my studies.
So
I went to work, you know. Marcelli made me some cue cards so I could learn how to read. I got me a brand new dictionary, one of them nice, pretty ones, and I liked it. I liked to have it around, and everybody would come and, man, let me see your dictionary.
Yeah.
And I was highlighting it, and first book I ever read was Malcolm X, and when I read Malcolm X's book, I saw that he couldn't read either. So then I felt kind of good, like, damn, Malcolm X, one of the baddest dudes that ever lived, and he couldn't read either. He taught himself how to read in jail. And then when I was reading the book, he talked about, if you lock us up, we're going to learn how to read and write. So I saw myself in Malcolm, you know. So he kind of gave me courage to go forward, to go hard. And I saw that I could do what Malcolm did.
Yeah.
You know, and I just started. I just went to work, man. But that's how I started reading.
Okay. So then you start writing books.
You're
a legit author, man.
Yeah, man. It was the book came about because all the youngsters used to come to me and ask me for game, you know. They was going home. Because, you know, when you're in federal prison, you're going to be in there with a guy that might be going home in 6 months.
Yeah.
And a guy with a life sentence might be in the same dorm, you know, might be living in the same space. So these youngsters used to come to me all the time, and they would be like, Rick, man, I never made $10,000 selling drugs. How was you able to make so much money? And I would just give them game, you know, like, look, man, I took all my money and reinvested it back into my sack.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want a car.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted a bigger sack.
Yeah.
You know, I started working to get a pound of, I started with an eighth. I had 125, my partner had 125. So we started with an eight, what we call the eight track.
Yeah.
And from the eight track, I wanted to get a seven. And from the seven, I wanted to get a half ounce. And then I wanted to get an ounce. And I just wanted to get bigger, 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 bigger. And I kept pooling all my money. The only money that I would take out was money that I was eating off of.
Yeah.
And I told him that was really my secret to being successful. And later on, I learned that they call that compound interest.
Right.
You know, where you're compounding your money back into the business. Then when I read Richest Man in Babylon, he said specifically that you're supposed to take that money out for yourself, you know, every time. Don't spend all your money on things that will be soon forgotten, I think is his correct word.
Okay.
You know, like you buy a pair of shoes, you wear them for a year, and they gone, and you throw them away, you forgot all about them. To take your money and buy things that you can remember, you know, things that's going to last, things that's going to be around, it's going to hold value. And that's basically what I did in the cocaine business, but unconsciously did it. So now I can consciously do those things because I know that these are the things that I should be doing.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I try to lace these dudes. You know, I spoke at the high school the other day, and a lot of the kids, they saw me on Vlad TV, so they was like, man, I saw you on Vlad. And I said, did you hear me when I told Vlad the only reason I talked to him is because y'all listen? Because if he wasn't teaching, he wasn't allowing me to teach y'all. Because really, I should have a reality show right now.
I see you going casting.
I am. I'm starting one. But I should have been had it. Really, we should have documented my whole journey since I got out of prison. I mean, it was a hell of a journey. You know, Floyd Mayweather picked me up from the halfway house. Yeah, so you're talking about it's been a journey that we could have got a lot of lessons from. It's been a lot of lessons lost. And that's kind of like this book, The 21 Keys.
Yeah.
The 21 Keys is kind of like those journeys. Yeah. Coley wrote with me every day.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Coley wrote with me every day, and he took notes,
yeah,
you know, of my journey. But I just wondering how much better it would have been if it would have been on film, you know. Because people love film more so than they like to read a book.
Visual learning.
But these books are definitely treasures. And I just shake my head that people are really slipping on these books, because when I wrote these books, I was trying to let them into my head. You know, I wanted them to know my mindset. Like I told you before, will you take the money or the brain?
Yeah, that's the biggest gem.
In The Richest Man in Babylon, he talks about it. He has a story where his father sends his son out to be a man. And he gives him two bags of gold, and he gives him some clay tablets. And when the son comes back, the son gives him back his two bags. No, he gave him back three bags of gold. And he said, for the clay tablets, I think I'm going to give you six bags of gold, because this is how much more I value your wisdom over your money. So basically what this kid was telling his dad was that your wisdom was six times more valuable to me than your gold was. And it's so important that we learn that, because sometimes only thing we're after is the money. And I'm saying, get the wisdom. The money will come. I tease people sometimes. I was talking to somebody the other day, and I say, you know, when I go and do a deal, I had the money right here, and then I had that bat right here. So if you don't take that money, I'm going to put that bat on you. I'm working on some major marijuana deals right now, and I'm going to put this bat on them. If they don't take this money, I'm going to put that bat on them. So we have to be in a position of power. You know, so often we work from a position of weakness instead of a position of strength. And I want our people to become powerful and strong. And, you know, I hate yesterday, you know, when I spoke to the kids, I should have ended it with, come and help me.
Okay.
I need help.
Yeah.
You know, will you help me? Will you come and be a part of this movement?
Yeah.
And show the world that we can do anything.
Yeah, nah, that's real. Yeah. So then, do you think down the road, do you think you would ever do like an online master class in a way?
I want to do that. I want to do an online master class. Or a TV show. Matter of fact, I'm talking to a network right now, Impact Network.
Okay.
I'm going to meet with the owner, and maybe he'll let me set something up like that. I have been trying I got all the way to the president of BET with the show too, where I was going to be taking kids that was about to go to jail, and the judge would give them one more chance and let them come and work with us, and I help them get their life back together. And BET dropped it at the last minute and said, oh, no, it's too serious.
Too positive. that's the one thing I don't understand. But then that's where we come in. We take over. Like you said, we do our own thing.
Yeah, we got to. Mm-hmm. We can't count on other people to look out for us.
Yeah.
You know, just like I couldn't count on my lawyer. My lawyer, when I found the issue that eventually got me out of prison, the lawyer who went to Harvard said I was wrong. If I would have listened to him, I would still be sitting in prison right now. Just luckily that I had enough confidence in myself and my reading ability and my understanding of the law that I said, no, put it on the record. Because he didn't even want to put it on the record.
Yeah.
And if you don't put it on the record, you can't appeal it.
Really?
man. I mean, you know, what y'all got to realize is when you hear me talk, you're hearing a guy with less than a second or third grade education going by the school system.
Yeah.
You know, if you went to my records, they would say that I was retarded.
Yeah.
And when you hear me talk right now, I know I don't sound retarded no more.
Oh, man, you're like, literally, you're the wisest guy I've met. Man, that's saved forever, you know, other than that, it's my dad, you know, like, this is not me just, like, talking.
So you ain't stroking me.
Bro, I'm mind blown right now, like, I'm sitting there in shock and literally just like, man, it's a lot that you can learn. And like you said, like, the brain, it's literally like, I want to be next to you, Mr. Ross, like...
Well, you know, our brain is our most valuable asset.
Yeah.
And so often that we forget how powerful the human brain is. I mean, the brain sends rocket ships out of space.
Yeah, and even then, like, we build the computers. And even, like, with AI, I'm pretty sure you're aware of it. With AI, like, as much as people deem it as a danger to us, we could still outthink that.
Yeah.
We put our minds to it.
Absolutely.
You know, and so that's, I don't know, Mr. Ross, like, yo, you, man, you dropping some gems.
Well, you know, I just wanted to share, you know, some things with you. You know, you're a young brother, and I feel that my wisdom could also assist you one day.
It will. In
your journey.
Look, I got the book yesterday, and I'm going to apply this. You know, literally.
And you should. You should check out its plausibility.
Yeah, it's a plausibility. Yes, sir.
You should check its plausibility to see it.
Yeah.
Is he lying or what?
No.
I want to know. Yeah. No, but you should want to know.
Yeah.
Is he lying?
Yeah.
Is he telling the truth?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so often, though, and we take other people at face value.
Yeah.
You know, they tell us something, and we believe that shit.
Yeah.
And we support them.
Yeah. And that's only because we too lazy to, like, you know,
to do the research.
Yeah, nah, that's crazy. And even then, so it's like, I don't know, man. Like, what's wrong? You keep coming with content. So, like, what's in it, like, in the near future? What other things we got going on?
Well, you know, my main thing right now, the low-hanging fruit, is the marijuana industry.
Yeah.
I think I got the deal worked out last night with the company that's gonna do the do.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They gonna take the cash.
Yeah.
So they don't feel that they're not gonna get the raft, but it's gonna be a bunch of them that have to feel the raft.
Yeah.
I'm gonna keep touring with my book.
Yeah. How many press media like companies have you went to over the past few days? Because I know your hustle is intense.
Man, I just left Oakland.
Yeah.
You know, I did about 8 or 9 in Oakland.
So, like, with your energy, do you do any coffee?
No, I don't do coffee. I'm on vitamin D right now. I'm also studying with the brain surgeon right now. So, don't be surprised if you see me in the surgery room one day doing brain surgery.
Oh. No, that's dope, man.
Yeah, yeah. I'm putting together a thing right now with one of the top brain surgeons in the world. He also thinks that he's going to be the one to come up with the cure for... what's the name of this disease? That coronavirus.
Really?
Yeah, he thinks he's gonna be the one.
Wow.
He says that he can kill anything.
Man, that's crazy. Speaking of the coronavirus, yesterday, man, I hop on Twitter and I see the CDC. A way to avoid getting the coronavirus. Guess what they want us to do?
What's that?
I'm not making this up. They want us to shave our beards. In order to avoid getting the coronavirus. This is something they literally tweeted.
What does a beard have to do with?
In my head, I go, is this overhyped? You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, matter of fact, we talked yesterday, me and the doc and one of my other partners was on the phone yesterday talking about it, and he said that the coronavirus is definitely a disease that nobody really knows about yet.
Really?
It has some components that they never saw. You know, he says it has like claws on it,
okay,
where it sticks to your body.
Okay.
It grabs you and it holds itself to you.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a disease that nobody really knows about. And he said it's going to probably be a pandemic.
Wow. Yeah, and I'm hearing that too. It's crazy. But I don't know, man. I'm just like, if anything, you got like, it makes me more of a germaphobe in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm catching myself washing my hands more than I usually do, and even like more showers. But then, so yeah, it seems like you're getting this heavily into the medical field, if anything.
Yeah, I am. I mean, well, you know, the goal is to help the people.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really to make money. I mean, I want to make money. I need money to pay my bills.
Yeah.
But
you're pro the people first.
But I'm pro the people first.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't, if I came up with a vaccine, a doc come up with a vaccine and I had something to do with it, it wouldn't be where he would be gouging. You know, I wouldn't, definitely would not be happy with gouging the people.
Yeah.
You know, I would definitely want it to be distributed, you know, fairly,
yeah,
and equally, you know.
Price.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and I'm hoping that I'm the one that helps him put this facility together. He doesn't, right now, he has a vitamin D that he created that clears the mind from old times, how you pronounce it, autism,
yeah, yeah.
The boxers. He got in touch with me because he saw me working with boxers.
Yeah, yeah.
So he reached out to me.
Yeah.
He saw me with the boxers. So he reached out to me. He said, you know, I can help your boxers.
Yeah.
And I was like, what you mean? He said, you know how they be slurring and punch drunk and whatnot. He said, I can clear their head up. I can get all those black spots out their brain. And I was like, what? And so I jumped on a plane the next morning and went and met with him. And we sit down and he bought me lunch and we talked and he told me about some of his concerns and some of the ways that this system has treated him.
Yeah.
You know, he's a black man, so
yeah.
He felt that the system hasn't treated him fairly.
Yeah.
You know, he's come up with things and they've taken them from him. And I mean, kind of like me, you know.
Yeah.
They took my name.
Yeah.
You know, they took my story.
Yeah.
You know, the TV show Snowfall, that's about my life.
Yeah.
Number one TV show on TV. I'm not getting a dime from it.
Yeah.
Not even a consultant credit.
Yeah, speaking of which, like, the impact that you have had on culture, do you watch these things happen? Do you care about it at all?
Kind of, you know, I mean, I feel flattered,
yeah,
you know, to have had such an impact on society. But now I want to have a positive. I want my grandkids to be able to say, yeah, my granddad, he stole cocaine for a little while.
Yeah.
You know, just for a little while. But look at all the other stuff he did.
Yeah. Nah,
when the coronavirus hit the world, he was one of the ones that helped
stop it.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Could you imagine how my grandkids would feel if they was able to say that?
Yeah.
You know, like, my granddad was a part of that.
Yeah.
So, those are the kind of things that I want to do right now.
Yeah.
You know, those are the things that I want to be remembered for. You
yeah.
know, and you know, I know they're gonna probably throw up the cocaine. You know,
yeah.
Oh, he sold drugs.
Yeah. That's the haters though. They only gonna focus on the negative.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking at what you're doing right now, and I'm like, I'm just amazed because I'm like, as an OG, like you literally, like I know your work ethic. You probably put in 100 hours a week minimum.
Probably so, or maybe more.
Yeah. But like for me, man, I'm looking at things now because I'm like, I just want to increase my work ethic, and you know, that's one of the things like you spoke on.
And you gotta enjoy it.
Gotcha.
You know, when you enjoy it, then you don't want to, you don't want to end it.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah.
You know, you want to just keep going. Like this is it.
Yeah.
You know, this is my ultimate high.
It drives you in a way.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what other things you got your hands on as
well? Oh, you know, I got my clothing on.
This
is my clothing line. Yeah. Feel the material.
Hey, dude, that's hella nice.
Yeah, so I'm planning on bringing, like, top quality clothes.
Yeah.
But for rock bottom prices.
Hey.
I mean, the same thing I did in the drug business. You know, I wanted to have the best cocaine I could get.
Yeah.
And sell it to them as cheap as I could sell it to them.
Yes.
So I'm doing that. I got the clothes going on. I still do my motivational speaking.
Where can people buy the
clothes? Oh, they can get it at my website, freeatrickyross.com. Also, you can get the book.
Yeah.
You can get the both the books.
Yeah.
You can get both the books there. Yeah. I also do cars. I got a car lot.
I heard you say
I sell cars.
Yeah.
What else am I doing? Oh, the movie. I'm working on the movie right now We've been wrestling with this script for about 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I want this story to be told the correct way.
Yeah.
I don't want no more snowfall bullshit out, you know, where they're glamorizing and making it look good and not giving people the facts.
Yeah.
I want kids to be able, when a kid read this book and he's thinking about getting into the drug business, he gonna know exactly what he's getting into.
Yeah.
He gonna know the ins and outs, what's gonna happen at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times they think at the end of the rainbow is a rap record.
Yeah.
You know, with Universal or Def Jam is gonna sign you.
Yeah.
You know, so I want him to know.
Yeah.
You know, that it could be some handcuffs, some cufflinks.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the rainbow for you.
Yeah.
So I'm doing that. What else am I doing? What else am I doing? I'm working on 2 reality shows. The boxing.
Yeah. How many hours of sleep do you get, man?
I get about 4 most days. 4.
You like? So I'm assuming that you're a part of the marijuana industry. You obviously smoke, but then do you?
I eat.
You eat.
I don't eat no alcohol.
Yeah.
No alcohol. Yeah. I never drunk. You know, every now and then I have an occasional drink, maybe twice a year. You know, I might drink some champagne, a little wine. But no, not a drinker. You know, drinking killed too many of my uncles and cousins and so forth. So, no, I'm not a drinker at all. And the only vitamins I'm taking right now is vitamin D. I'm a vegan, though. You know, I've been a vegan for 30 years. I found out I didn't need meat to live.
But then anybody come to you with that idea, like, hey, you should try this?
One of my friends, he made me a bet that I couldn't do it for 6 months.
$100. $100, really?
Yeah, he made me a $100 bet that I couldn't do it. I won $100. I spent that $100. and when I went back to eat meat, I got sick.
Gotcha.
So
I might as well stay on the path.
Might as well stay where I'm at.
Yeah.
I'm getting everything I need. I don't feel any different.
Yeah.
And he gave me a book too called Do You Live to Eat or Eat to Live? And in that book, I saw that there was people that wanted me to eat meat who really didn't care about me.
Gotcha. And like that's the main, that's the corporate. Yeah, that's crazy, man. So do you think, like, cause by you being in health, do you ever think you would do a food product?
Oh, I definitely want to do food products.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, everything that they do, I want to have a part in it. Because we should have alternatives.
Yeah.
You know, we should have choices.
Yeah. And even like, you know, growing up, I grew up in Detroit. So growing up like in the hood, you just like, you don't know.
You don't know your choices.
Yeah.
If you don't know you have choices, then you don't have a choice.
Yeah.
And if you never exercise your choice, then you don't have a choice.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope y'all are listening. Listening is giving game. He's giving it casually.
I try to, man. But we have to exercise our choices, you know. If you smoke cigarettes and you think that you could quit or you don't need cigarettes, then you have to try one day.
Yeah.
You know, and see if you can quit.
Nah, seriously, that's one of my things now. I'm like, for me, it's drinking. I'm going to tap out, you know. My goal is to do, literally, my birthday is May 9th. So the goal is just to, like, tap out, man. And by then, I want to.
You tapped out already? Today.
Today,
yes, sir. Why leave something for tomorrow that you could do today?
Hey, that's procrastination side.
You can't be a procrastinator.
Yeah. Nah, that's real.
My man in The Richest Man in Babylon, he said procrastination has killed so many men's dreams.
Yeah. Nah, seriously. And I can see it, man. And even then, like, even listening to you talk, it's like, I picture you a go-getter. Whatever you see, like, that interests you.
I go for it.
Yeah.
I go for it. I don't wait.
Yeah.
Why wait?
Yeah.
Why wait till tomorrow?
Yeah. And so, like, what's the next big thing that you're, like, totally, like, because I know it's a big goal in mind.
Well, I mean, working with the doc is big.
Yeah.
You know, he's talking about helping people with old timers, with football players, with the black spots, and then if he comes up with a cure for this coronavirus, I mean, that stuff is like, you really can't get no bigger than that, you know. But I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if people see me maybe on a basketball team or football team or something like that there. I could see those things. So maybe, I don't know, maybe I'll buy Apple or Microsoft, too. You know, while I'm buying stuff, I just might go and buy those companies up as well. Because I study corporate takeovers. So I want to take over a couple of big companies just to show people, look, man, this game is, it's like playing Monopoly, man. It's all fake. They just keep printing it. You know, that money don't really have no value. No way.
So, wrapping it up, if you could give people 5 things to walk away with, game-wise.
I'm going to give them some straight game.
Okay.
Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. As a Man Think by James Allen. Richest Man in Babylon by George Clasi. Freeway Rick Ross, Untold Autobiography.
Yeah.
Ricky Ross, 21 Keys to Success. Go get them.
Get that, y'all. Man, I appreciate you giving me the time, the opportunity, too. Like,
I'm glad to see you wrote in, man. I like to see young brothers getting it, man. And I hope that that I'll be able to mentor you and you mentor me.
It's a
sharp mind sharpening each other.
Yeah, it's like you said, the brain. Like, really,
Let him keep his money. Yeah. Keep your money. I don't want your money. I'm going to give you some money.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you some money.
Yeah.
I want that brain.
Yeah. No, for sure. Mr. Ross, where can people follow you at?
They can follow me at Freeway Ricky on all social media. I'm trying to hit that 200,000 mark right now, so go check me out. Yeah, I'm going to hit it anyway. It's that thing starting to grow. And the internet ain't caught up with me yet. See, I got the internet tricked.
Yeah.
I'm running the trick on the internet, and they don't even know yet.
Yeah.